Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You'll often hear it said that Ireland punches above its weight in terms of the amount of poets and writers it produces. Now, there's a truth to that. Names like W.B. Yeats, James Joyce and Samuel Beckett are just some of the internationally recognised Irish writers who have stood the test of time. However, giving credit to Irish society for producing these greats isn't necessarily accurate. Or at least it distorts the relationship many of these writers had with Ireland. Indeed, many Irish writers were marginalised in the Ireland they grew up in, particularly those who lived through the decades after independence. If they cast a critical eye over life on the island, or were from religious minorities, they found themselves considered outsiders and marginalised. Now, this was particularly the case in the 1930s, That was a strange decade in Ireland. The island seemed out of kilter with broader global events. Around the world, it was a time of dramatic history. It witnessed growing tensions between fascism and anti-fascism, which would lead to the Spanish Civil War and then ultimately the Second World War. But life in Ireland was somewhat different. The dramatic events of the revolutionary era were firmly in the rear view, and the optimism and hope it had engendered had long faded. By the 30s, a narrow understanding of Irish identity, synonymous with Catholicism and political conservatism, had taken hold. Needless to say, this alienated many Irish people, and while a new generation of writers did emerge, many would have to leave Ireland to escape poverty, but also an increasingly stifling cultural atmosphere. This podcast explores their stories by looking at what life in Ireland in the 30s was like and then following the lives of some of these writers into exile. It also looks at what life in London was like, where many of these writers would choose to live, where they would rub shoulders with some of the most famous writers of the age, but were also increasingly drawn into the dramatic politics of that decade as Europe hurtled towards the Second World War. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. This podcast explores exiled Irish writers in the 30s and my guest is Katrina Goldstone. Katrina is a cultural historian and her latest book, Irish Writers and the 30s, is a fascinating insight into the lives of these Irish writers who, for one reason or another, found themselves marginalised in Ireland. We'll hear the stories of Leslie Dakin, a Dublin Jew, and Charlie Donnelly, a Catholic from Tyrone, as well as others. Now, before we dive into this story, I want to flag some other great shows that are coming down the line in the next few weeks, which includes a podcast on the marriage that changed the course of Irish history next week. That is, of course, the wedding of Aoife and Strongbow in 1170. That's followed by a show on the history of photography, where we'll be talking about some of the oldest photographs taken in Ireland and why there are no photographs of the Great Hunger. Then after that, we'll head back to the Middle Ages for an interview with Dr. Eileen Murphy on groundbreaking new evidence about what life was like in Ireland at the time. Last year, Eileen concluded her analysis of hundreds of medieval remains, and this interview is really fascinating. We cover everything from living to the many, many ways people died. So all those shows are coming in the next few weeks. so make sure you've subscribed to the show to get those when they drop. Finally, today's conversation is based around Katrina's book, Irish Writers in the 30s. She focuses on the lives of four writers and really captures the decade of the 30s, not only in Ireland, but also in London. Now, if you're interested in the 30s, and particularly if literary or cultural history is your thing, I can't recommend this enough. I've links to the book in the show notes below. Sound on today's show was by Kate Dunlea. We started our conversation as Katrina explained how she started writing about the 30s. She was researching Irish government policy towards Jewish refugees at the time. She now explains how this gave her an insight into that dramatic decade and the major international events that would shape the lives of the people discussed in this episode, but also what was happening in Ireland at the time as well.
As a prerequisite for that, I had to read up about all the background of the decade. And prior to that, I probably would have been like most of us in the big, you know, the big picture of the 30s, the Great Depression, the rise of fascism, the era of dictators, which, of course, it is all those things. But there's so much more going on. It always struck me as the sort of sheer drama of the decades. And I mean, those images which we have, the severe economic depression, how that affected America and Britain and Europe. Of course, we have the images of Germany, people, you know, wheeling wheelbarrows of devalued currency, the starkness, you know, the soup kitchens, the dole queues, the hunger marches, all of this. And then, of course, but in Ireland, we don't have the same, you know, either imagery or focus points. All of these things, of course, are easy hooks to get people in, if you like, and they're shorthand and they're not necessarily going to represent complexity, but it's a way in, right?
Ireland was by no means immune from the various crises that would drive this dramatic history on the continent. But as I said at the outset, while Europe would witness major clashes over its future, Ireland, to a certain extent, appeared to have settled its course, given the revolutionary era was firmly in the past. However, Katrina explained how the decades after independence, and particularly the 30s, witnessed nation-building as a sense of nationalism nurtured by the Catholic Church and the state was embedded in society. This presented a narrow understanding of what it meant to be Irish. It romanticised rural peasant life, and what might be called official Irish identity, at least, became synonymous with Catholicism and politically conservative views. This was obviously highly exclusionary. A lot of Irish people were not conservative or Catholic. However, in this short clip, Katrina explains how this nation-building and nationalism could affect writers. Successful writers at home would need to fit in with this idea as well.
This vision of Ireland, the post-independence, had to be imbuing nationalism throughout the cultural sphere.
Next, we moved to talk about those excluded or marginalised by this process. Now, this was by design. Katrina explains how she repeatedly came across the word alien being used to describe people, things or ideas, which obviously implied some people were somehow not Irish.
I was really struck by the use of the word alien. And you get a debate in the Dáil about use, alien penetration of industry, alien names. So we're getting definitions of Irishness and, by opposition, what is alien to the new vision.
It goes without saying that this was hardly a conducive atmosphere to nurture creativity of any kind. Yet a generation of writers would emerge who, despite the prevailing ideas, were outsiders in Ireland to one degree or another. Now, we chatted about two of these writers, who Katrina has looked at in detail. The first was Leslie Udeikin, a Jewish writer from Dublin. His religious background and his left-wing politics saw him marginalised. But as Katrina talked about his life, you get a real sense of how Udeikin, who would change his name to Dakin, would find himself pushed to the periphery in Ireland.
Leslie Dakin, he changed his name to Dakin, was born in 1912 into the, you know, small Jewish community in Ireland. His father was, it says, rubber merchant. I think it's really trading in tires and whatever else he could find. And father died young. The original family were various branches come from Lithuania. So he's born in, he goes to Trinity College where he studied Maud Lang, French, and he was a pupil student of Samuel Beckett. He had at a very young age literary ambitions. He was in those circles also in UCD where, the, you know, how he eventually met Charlie Donnelly through a mutual friend, Niall Sheridan. And they're, you know, they've got literary ambition. They want to be poets. And he's quite precocious. He wins essays. You know, he seems to be a burgeoning talent in the literary scene.
As we'll see later in this episode, Dakin was not the only one of his generation who was forced to leave Ireland because it was hard to fulfil his literary ambitions at home. However, before we moved on, we did talk about another Irish writer who left. His background was somewhat different to Dakin's. Charlie Donnelly was a Catholic, but like Dakin, was a left-wing radical, and this would see him marginalised. If his name does sound familiar, Donnelly gained posthumous fame when he was killed in the Spanish Civil War.
Charles Donnelly is an Irish Catholic and coming from quite a religious family, but originally from Tyrone. And they moved to Dublin and they were in and around Mountjoy, Parnell Square. And his brother then came face to face with a sort of poverty that he'd never seen before, which radicalized him, if you like. And he then becomes involved in Republican Congress, which Leslie Dakin also was. So that's the early 30s, the socialist, when you're getting a marriage of Republican and socialist ideas in this small, relatively small organization, but influential, I would say.
It's easy to see how the nation building, which obviously did inspire some writers, alienated and marginalized people like Donnelly and Dakin. They were considered outsiders because of their politics, and in Dakin's case, because he was Jewish.
And they're politically marginalized by being on the left, right? And if we're thinking of the nation building that's taking place in the 1930s and cultural nationalism and what is deemed to be a reflection of Irishness, I suppose, all of these things come into play. Dakin and Donnelly were both huge admirers of James Connolly, for instance. And I mean, when you get the Irish Free State and what's happening in terms of, as I say, nation building, they are most definitely politically marginalized. And then of course Dakin and Milne and Sayers are, one might say, marginalized by being part of religious minorities.
It's worth saying that writers like Dakin and Donnelly did write about Irish society, but because they would highlight some of the problems, they did struggle. Now, when we talked about this, it gives you a sense of just how narrow the cultural space in Ireland was. As Katrina addressed this, it struck me that today, a writer would almost be expected to acknowledge social problems.
There is writing about poverty, for sure, and conditions in Ireland. But when, say, Dakin writes a poem about conditions of workers, he's putting it within a socialist framework. He wrote a poem, Song to Sean Reardon, which was about an actual case where an Irish worker was basically suffocated in a trench. And Dakin wrote a poem about this.
Life did not in any way become easier for these people as the 1930s wore on. Katrina went on to explore how they would become only more marginalised as Ireland became extremely anti-communist and anyone with left-wing sympathies was treated with suspicion.
I mean, you get the development of a kind of an anti-communist ethos is coming in early 1930s. But the Home Affairs is worried about the IRA going communistic. So the state, if you like, is also saying we're suspicious of people who hold these views. And that could mean you mightn't get a job, you mightn't get work, all sorts of different repercussions. So between both the religious minority and the political minority, there are certainly, you know, outsiders.
Somewhat inevitably, many of these writers emigrated. When we talked about why they emigrated, we had a fascinating discussion. There's a highly romanticised image of an exiled Irish writer who leaves Ireland because the culture was so stifling. Now, that is true to an extent, but Katrina was keen to point out that these writers were affected by the same issues that drove emigration in the wider population in the 1930s. That was unemployment and the lack of opportunity at home.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The economics, you know, is totally central as well. I mean, obviously, it was great that they could meet all these, but, you know, they were going to be able to get work. I mean, both a basic kind of work for day jobs and, you know, they write about trying to get the jobs. And Ewart Mill says it was hard little jobless brother in London in those years. So, I mean, it's also, you know, they were lucky with some of the connections. But yes, of course, the main thing was we've got more chance of getting some kind of employment and cultural exposure elsewhere. But I think it was Mary Daly was talking about the sort of exodus. Of course, so much and the great deal of emigration was to Britain in the 30s up until the war.
Also, contrary to what you might expect, given Ireland's reputation for producing writers, it was extremely difficult to be a writer of any kind in the 1930s, no matter what you were writing about, even if you did fit in with the prevailing attitudes. The Irish Free State was a small market with less demand to somewhere like Britain.
It was also just blinking difficult to be a writer or artist in Ireland. I mean, you didn't have the book buying public, you didn't have the range of publishers, you didn't have sort of very basic level. You know, I mean, you have the journals, you know, you've got Ireland Today from 36 to 38, where you might be reviewed, or through the newspapers. Now, the newspapers are very lively book pages, for sure. People are interested, but it's not going to be on the scale you will get elsewhere. And, you know, there's no state support or whatever.
Now, many of these writers moved to London. Katrina explains how they really found themselves in the right place at the right time in London in the 30s. They would rub shoulders with literary greats like T.S. Eliot and George Orwell. But London was also a hive of left-wing activity. They would, in many ways, find themselves in the perfect place at the perfect time.
They're coming from a place where, for better or worse, they feel marginalised, both, you know, partly personally and also culturally. But London at that time, there was what I call a cultural infrastructure, a bigger cultural infrastructure, which means periodicals, little newspapers, larger magazines like the Criterion with T.S. Eliot, who encouraged Michael Sayers, who's one of the writers in the book. I mean, here's an 18-year-old lad who writes to T.S. Eliot, right, as a dreaming of being a poet. And he gets a response. And when he goes to London, T.S. Eliot helps him and gives him some gigs as a drama critic. I mean, he's corresponding with, you know, he's gone from Dublin, where he's feeling quite disgruntled, and going into this sort of fervent atmosphere, I suppose, is what I'm conjure up. And some of the, I mean, I've got one photograph of Leslie Dakin standing supposedly at a meeting in Hyde Park Corner, haranguing a very small or non-existent crowd. They have so many different networks that they can plug into there. So you have both the political networks of people who are interested in socialism and left-wing culture. You have also Ewart Milne, who's also over there in the mid-30s in London, Dakin and Donnelly, they produce Irish Front, a newsletter for Irish workers. They go to Gaelic League meetings. And, you know, they're plugging into the Irish diasporic networks. They're plugging into left-wing networks. And they're plugging in then to the bigger cultural ferment, which is very much energized at the time, full of debate. You've got the Left Review magazine, which was 34 to 38, where there's lots of debate about socially committed literature. Then you have a publication like New English Weekly, which George Orwell contributed to, Dakin contributed to occasionally. And of course, I mean, Michael Sayers eventually ends up sharing a flat with George Orwell, Eric Blair as was, you know, up in Kentish Town. So they're definitely, they've got so many choices in a way that they didn't have the same choices. And I feel, you know, Dakin's little unpublished memoir, plus a lot of the other stuff that I've read about the liveliness of the atmosphere, wanting to go and look at Soviet films, going up to Conway Hall to get a political talk. You know, there's a whole area around High Holborn, Bloomsbury, where they're dashing about. Milne and Dakin are, you know, producing this Irish Front newsletter. Then there's another Irish Freedom newspaper. They're running from one place to the other. You get the sense of energy and optimism. That is certainly what Dakin writes about, that they really felt that they could change the world. And then they get involved in Spanish Civil War efforts. So, as I say, they've just got this richness of a cultural life, both in what they the events they can attend and what they can contribute to.
Now, while they found themselves in London, these writers did have a complex relationship to Ireland. They had found it a difficult and hard place to live, but they had a strong attachment to home. Katrina began by explaining the reactions of one of this generation, Ewart Milne, and how they voiced their complex relationship with Ireland in their work.
Ewart Milne, in his collection, Letter from Ireland, you know, he could still, and he was much more cynical than Leslie Dakin, for instance, about the way he believed he was treated by Irish, you know, greater society. But I mean, even he will write lyric poems and have, in a way, the idea that the critique is not meant solely as a critique, but as a hope that a better Ireland could come out of it. Do you know what I mean? So there is a feeling there of contributing back in some ways.
Leslie Dakin voiced similar attitudes in his work as well.
For instance, Dakin's Shamrocks to Mayakovsky talks about, you know, the poor knocking on the mansion house gate, talks about the crowds coming up to the mansion house of people who are, you know, on rent strike. All of this within the poem is, again, this affection that you want it to be better. You want the place to be better, to have better conditions, have better social conditions. And it's both an affection and an ambivalence that's reflected, and in something like Shamrocks for Mayakovsky. But the other thing I think about that poem is I talk about, it's not the idea of a poem as a witness poem, right? So all the rent strikes, the poverty, the TB, the conditions, the social conditions in Ireland, you know, in some ways, Dakin compresses these into the poem, you know, the references to these social conditions.
Now, so far, we've just focused on male writers. There were female writers, but as Katrina explains, they faced even more challenges than their male counterparts.
If it was difficult to be a cultural person in any way in Ireland in the 30s, it was doubly, trebly, quadruply more difficult to be a woman with creative ambitions, because of the new formations, because of all sorts of, you know, overt and covert sexism, shall we say, as well, this idea that you're going to be independent and creative. I mean, and as for getting any sort of living out of it, nearly impossible. I mean, Rosamund Jacob had it in her journals about, you know, you go through the years, hardly any money, you know, hardly any earnings put in various years as you know, and they offer one another lodgings. They do all sorts of strategies to support one another. But that is to compensate, if you like, for the difficulty of expressing literary ambition and the actual practicality. But I think it's absolutely miraculous, given the societal opprobrium of asserting yourself as a creative person, given the practicalities and the economics, that you did get women writing at all.
Throughout our conversation, Katrina had highlighted how radical left-wing beliefs have played an important role in inspiring many of these exiled writers. In many ways, these beliefs would be crystallised in the Spanish Civil War, which broke out in 1936. This life and death struggle between fascism and anti-fascism has been heavily romanticised in literature. Writers from across the world, most famously Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell, would eulogise the anti-fascist struggle. Irish writers were no different. And one of the writers we discussed, Charlie Donnelly, would actually travel to Spain and was killed at the Battle of Jarama in 1937. Now, as we talked about Donnelly and the war, Katrina explains how the conflict kind of strangely seemed to focus his creativity.
Donnelly also becomes involved with the Spanish Medical Aid Committee. This then pushes him towards action, that you must oppose fascism through action. He's working in this building on Oxford Street where Ewart Mill, another person I write about, is working. And they're, you know, they're getting together supplies for the casualties of the Spanish Civil War. And then Donnelly is just gets this, it must be action, we must oppose. And of course, he joins the International Brigades and is later killed. Interestingly, some of the accounts say that when he first comes to London, he's very much doing political writing. He's not doing the poetry, which he, of course, became famous for, a reputation resting on just four poems. But if you think of, he's often compared to John Cornford, again, the sort of boy poet who's charismatic and, you know, dies very young. But I mean, I was interested that he was, you know, he was concentrating a lot on political writing. And then in the months, just when he's making the decision to go to Spain, his friends are noticing he's writing the poetry. He's talking about even, you know, fiction. And this continues when he goes to Spain.
As the 30s drew to a close, the world was clearly moving into a new age with the outbreak of the Second World War. The climate and atmosphere that had nurtured these writers' work began to dissipate. Some would find themselves marginalised again in the post-war world.
But I take the 1930s as a sort of a great era of potential for them. And you can say whether or not necessarily that was fulfilled because of difficult life events, for starters. And then, like Milne would then say, that once you got into the 50s, the political affiliations that you had and his perception as a socialist or anti-fascist, I mean, he writes in one of his letters to Austin Clark that basically anti-fascism isn't in anymore. And then I think this is the late 50s, that it's a liability to have some of these labels attached to yourself.
For others, it was life itself that moved on. Leslie Dakin started a family, and obviously his focus became providing for his children. But he did enjoy a degree of literary success in the 1960s.
Post-war, I mean, he's doing a lot of different types of freelance gigs, working for Berlitz, Lingophone, still maintaining the literary ambitions, but he becomes a father, he's got two daughters, so then he's moving into providing for them and responsibilities while still continuing, you know, certainly up until the 50s. And of course, from my point of view, he leaves us one of the few insider accounts of the Jewish community with his play, The Circular Road, which is produced on the BBC and repeated, then done also on RTE late. It starts, he tries to get it off the ground in the 50s, and then it's 60 to 60 that it is broadcast. And this is about the South Circular Road in the 1920s, basically the world of his childhood.
I want to thank Katrina for her time. I've links to her book, Irish Writers and the 30s, in the show notes below. Next week, I'll be back with a show on the marriage that changed Irish history. That's the story of Aoife and Strongbow. Until then, Sloan.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.